Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation and Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, June 29, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss improving the use of science in regulation. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome return guest Susan E. Dudley. It's the Honorable Susan E. Dudley. She's the Director of the Regulatory Studies Center and a Distinguished Professor at the George Washington University. So with a welcome, Susan Dudley, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Dean. The missing piece was the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. Everybody on this phone knows I am not a lawyer. But I have been involved in regulatory policy for a long time and have tried to put my finger on why environmental policies in particular can be so contentious. Effective regulatory policy that focuses resources on addressing real threats to public health and the environment depends on reliable scientific information and also transparent policy choices. But often these regulations are the subject of heated debate involving accusations of politicized science. Now, I don't think anyone wants science to be politicized, but I'm also convinced that no one is immune to the temptation to spin science to advance a predetermined policy goal. Science can be politicized when political decision makers attempt to distort scientific findings, and that's what we hear about most often. But in my experience, it's equally problematic, although much less visible, when scientists and other analysts attempt to exert influence on policy decisions by how they present scientific information. In 2009, the Bipartisan Policy Center issued a report on improving the use of science in regulatory policy, which I recommend to anybody who's interested in this topic. And they concluded that, quote, a tendency to frame regulatory issues as debates solely about science, regardless of the actual subject in dispute, is at the root of the stalemate and acrimony all too present in the regulatory system today. I also think former EPA Assistant Administrator Milt Russell said it well when he said that while government scientists need to be protected from, quote, influence over what they find and report, policymakers must also be protected from policy analysts or scientists telling them what they should decide. And it's this latter phenomenon that I observed firsthand when I was in government, and what my working paper with Marcus Peacock focuses on. Now, just by way of background, for the last 2 years of the Bush administration, I was head of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs that reviews the regulations of all federal agencies, all executive branch agencies. And Marcus at this time was the deputy administrator for EPA. So we dealt with a lot of these issues when we were in government. And what we've identified two problems that we think the current set of regulatory institutions tend to aggravate. The first is when scientists, intentionally or not, insert but don't disclose their own policy preferences in the scientific advice they provide decision makers. We call this hidden policy judgments, but others have called it advocacy science or normative science. The second is when scientists or policymakers camouflage controversial policy decisions as science. For this, we adopt Wendy Wagner's colorful term, the science charade. Now, institutional arrangements in the regulatory development process tend to aggravate both hidden policy judgments and science charades. They threaten the credibility of the scientific process, and they harm the resulting regulatory policy. And many people involved in regulatory decisions have incentives to hide policy preferences, such as how to deal with the uncertainty and assessments of risk, and to dismiss and denigrate dissenting views. Key policy choices disguised as science too often rest with technical staff. Meanwhile, policymakers charged with making tough policy decisions are able to avoid responsibility by claiming that their hands were tied by the science. So let me just back up a little bit and explain why this is such a difficult problem to solve. We all want to make sure that our policies are based on sound science, so it's easy to fall prey to the is-ought fallacy. That is, not recognizing that while science is essential for understanding the positive question of what is, or predicting what outcomes might obtain under different scenarios, it is not sufficient for making normative decisions regarding what ought to be. Sound policy decisions regarding how to manage risks typically need to consider a host of non-scientific factors, such as economic feasibility, legal constraints, ethical considerations, interactions with other public policies, etc. Now, ideally, policy decisions would involve a risk assessment component that is largely science-based and a risk management component that weighs different considerations. But it's hard to make a clear distinction between those two components and to keep hidden policy judgments from creeping into the risk assessment. In part, this is because when assessing risks, scientists will never have complete information to predict outcomes with certainty. So they rely on assumptions, on judgments, and rules of thumb. These various judgments, including which science to consider, how individual studies are weighed and combined, how to handle competing theories, which models to use, etc., can have very large impacts on the resulting assessment of risk. And these embedded judgments, intentionally or not, can bias the ultimate advice provided to decision makers and the public. And we're usually unaware of the influence that these hidden policy judgments or that there are alternative choices that are equally plausible. Instead, assessments often generate precise-sounding predictions that hide not only considerable uncertainty about actual risk, but the reliance on biased inferences and assumptions for handling that uncertainty. These hidden policy judgments obscure the boundary between science and policy and contribute to politicized science through biased science advice. Then compounding this problem is the science charade, where scientists or policymakers justify a policy decision in purely scientific or scientific-sounding terms without revealing the judgments and policy factors that played a role in the decision. Congress and policymakers contribute to science charades by disguising value-laden decisions as the necessary result of the best science. So policymakers and scientists, they may intentionally contribute to this is-ought fallacy, but for different reasons. Scientists may want to influence policymakers by subtly absorbing non-scientific assumptions in their risk assessments or in descriptions of what is, so it appears there is no better risk management alternative than the one that they prefer. Decision makers, who may fear criticism over a particular decision, can muddle descriptions of what is with assumptions regarding what ought to be and claim that the science dictated an outcome. So in our working paper, which is probably going to be part of a symposium issue for the Supreme Court Economic Review, Marcus and I used the process by which EPA sets National Ambient Air Quality Standards, or NAAQS, under the Clean Air Act, to illustrate some of the perverse incentives involved in developing regulations, which can encourage biased science advice and the science charade. We thought that the NAAQS process is particularly worth examining because on the one hand, it's held up by some as an ideal by which all science-based rulemaking should be developed, but on the other, NAAQS decisions are among the most controversial of all of EPA's policies. Each of the last three presidents has taken the very unusual step of publicly and personally intervening in EPA's regulatory decision on these NAAQS. So I think the problem begins with the statute itself. The Clean Air Act directs EPA to set the standards at levels that protect public health with an adequate margin of safety. And that falls prey to the is-ought fallacy by restricting the agency from openly considering relevant non-scientific factors. That, combined with tight deadlines, permits Congress to take credit for laudable goals, who doesn't want clean air, while blaming the executive branch's execution for any undesirable outcomes. And then the courts have reinforced the limited interpretation of the Act, as well as tight deadlines for issuing revised standards. They have to be issued every 5 years. Then executive branch career and policy officials respond by hiding policy judgments and developing scientific-sounding explanations to justify one standard over another. And public interveners vigorously defend alternative standards based on their own interpretations of the science, none of them talking about other trade-offs. Scientists argue for the primacy of their data. Analysts have an incentive to downplay rather than reveal uncertainties in their predictions. And decision makers point to science as either requiring a new standard or as determining that existing standards are adequate. So it's no surprise that this has evolved into an adversarial process, characterized by harsh rhetoric in which each party claims the science supports its preferred policy outcome and questions opponents' credibility and motives, rather than a constructive discussion regarding appropriate data, assumptions, and policy decisions. The real reasons for selecting a particular standard may not even be discussed. I think this harms the credibility of science advice and results in poorer decision-making. So what can be done? I think the first step would be to clarify which aspects of decisions are matters of science and which are matters of policy. As the Bipartisan Policy Center that I quoted earlier said, quote, this transparency would both help force value debates into the open and could limit spurious claims about and attacks on science. When people condemn the politicization of science, the problem may really be that we ask too much of science in addressing policy problems. So in our paper, Marcus and I offer 10 recommendations, and I'm just going to summarize a few of them briefly. First, we must recognize that science is a positive discipline that it can inform, but not decide appropriate policy. In drafting authorizing legislation, Congress should not delegate decisions to agencies on the pretense that science alone can make the normative determination of what policy ought to be. Second, while science advisory panels can provide a necessary and valuable source of information and peer review for agencies, greater effort should be made to restrict their advice to matters of science and not ask them to recommend policy. And this is actually quite timely, even though we set up this teleformal a while ago. EPA has a new opportunity to do this. Just this week, it announced that it's seeking nominations for its science advisory panels, including the Clean Air Science Advisory Council, which provides advice on these ambient air quality standards. As EPA goes about selecting its members, it should pay attention to advice that the Keystone Center, in a report in 2012, the center emphasized that, quote, all potential panelists will have conscious and unconscious biases. And knowing that, it's important to select panelists with diverse perspectives and expertise, but who are willing to engage in open discussion and to consider other views. Third, risk assessments necessarily involve assumptions and judgments, as well as pure scientific inputs, yet they often generate precise-sounding predictions that hide not only considerable uncertainty about actual risk, but hidden judgments. Greater transparency regarding the assumptions and policy rationales for choosing one set of assumptions or models over another would encourage more openness and constructive discussion about science and about policy. And fourth and finally, the scientific method depends on falsifiable hypotheses, on data gathering, replication, dissent, and challenge. Reforms that intentionally engage rather than avoid competing views and that subject scientific predictions to ex post evaluation would go a long way toward improving underlying science and the decisions that depend on it. In our paper, we have several specific recommendations on this theme, including sharing underlying data sets, providing advance notices for rules, conducting retrospective review, and designing regulation at the outset to facilitate natural experimentation and learning. So let me just wrap up. Our paper focuses on a case study of how EPA sets NAAQS under the Clean Air Act, but I think our observations and recommendations have broader applications. Effective regulatory policy that focuses resources on addressing real threats to public health and the environment depends on reliable scientific information and transparent policy choices. I think our recommendations have the potential to reduce the acrimony and improve the debate over environmental policy by exposing the science charade, avoiding the Izzat fallacy, and making more transparent previously hidden policy judgments. This could improve not only environmental outcomes, but also the integrity of science advice. So, Dean, I'll stop there.
Terrific. Well, thank you. That's a nice outline of where you're headed with this article. Let's open it up to questions from the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question for our expert. So once again, we've got lots of time left. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me start things off here, if I could. It sounds to me almost like you're saying, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so I'll phrase this in the form of a question. Are you saying that there's no such thing as settled science in the sense that even when good policy judgments are made on the basis of science, they need to be constantly revisited and subject to reopen based on new developments in science? And that's something that I believe, and I would cite something as fundamental as the temperature of the human body, which was forever understood to be 98.6 degrees, but then accepted, so never revisited. But after a study by Harvard, I think in 2005 or 6 or 7 or something like that, they decided the new body temperature is 98.2. And I think there wasn't an indication that the human body temperature had changed so much as the instrumentation had changed or the study methods had changed, and 98.2 is the better figure. But can you make policy judgments based on science and then close the book on them, or are they always subject to being revisited?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I didn't know about the body temperature. I always just thought I was cold. I think, you know, there are some things that are clearly settled. You know, the Earth is round, the Earth is not flat. So, I mean, I think that there are some things where science is settled, but I do think it kind of brings us back to the scientific method that we learned in high school, that it depends on you. You put forth a hypothesis, and then you conduct experiments to test it. You learn from that, and that provides that feedback loop. So there's constant challenge and exploration of alternative theories to explain what we see. And sometimes when people will say the science is settled, they're trying to close off that discussion. So I think that that's an important point. So I'm not sure I would go so far as to say science is never settled, but I think if there is still dispute over things, that there may be, it may be worth more analysis and more examination.
Right. Right. Once again, to the audience, if you have a question, our lines are wide open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We're happy to take your questions. We do have one question on the board right now. It almost seems to me that if you accept the notion that science is settled, and I would go, I grant you the Earth is round, the Earth is not flat, but if we accepted science had done all it could, for example, we'd be stuck in 1950s medicine or 1920s medicine. There's just so many evolutions and revolutions. Not in my lifetime, but I remember reading that there was, in the 1920s and 30s, it was thought that the strength of the atom, individual atoms, was such that you could never split an atom. And within 20 years, it had been done, revolutionizing energy and warfare. But now we have three questions, so I will stop my rambling and turn to. Oh, I'm sorry, Susan. Did you want to say something?
I'll quickly just respond a little more than that. I mean,
sure.
In agencies, I mean, they do have to make decisions, and they often have tight deadlines from Congress.
Right.
I think that's why writing your regulations in a way that allows that continued learning and experimentation and being open to that is so important in the regulatory process, and it's often missing.
Right. That's helpful. I think I have activated the phone line of our first caller. Go right ahead, caller.
Yeah, Chris Garvey here. The Earth is slightly bulging at the center, so it's equator, so it's not quite round. And in fact, I have a song I wrote about all the things that were settled of medical science on my YouTube channel. Now it's just some nonsense doctors used to know. And it all the things I listed didn't fit in the song. Anyway, what is the Izzat fallacy? I tuned in a little late because when I tried coming in, there was blank and I missed it. The Izzat fallacy.
Yeah, so it's normative positive fallacy. So saying it's the fallacy that the science will tell us what the right answer is. And so my suggestion is that science alone cannot tell you what the answer is. Even something that we would say is settled still doesn't tell you what your policy options should be. That requires other factors like economics and law, engineering. You know, there's just a lot of other factors that need to go into a policy decision. So I was probably slurring my words, Chris, but it's dash ought.
Oh, is ought. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions on the board, then we're open to other questions. Let's take another call.
Hey, this is Paul Cavender. I felt like I was drinking out of a fire hose here. The information was so good and coming so quick. The paper that's referenced, when will it be available and how can it be obtained?
I think that we could probably post it soon, Paul. I have an earlier version of it on our website, and maybe by the time I'll give you the overall website, and maybe by the time the call is over, or maybe the better thing to do is I can give it to Dean, and anybody who wants it can email it to either Dean or me. So my email address is sdudley@gwu.edu, and the paper from I think it was from 2015 perhaps is posted at www.regulatorystudies.gwu.edu.
Thank you very much.
This is a revised version that's been submitted to the Supreme Court Economic Review. I don't know what issue it might be in.
We will also make a posting on the Federal Society blog. I'm going to ask our folks to do that with that same information. So there's another avenue to find the paper. Again, if you have a question for our expert, Susan Dudley, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Still two questions pending, so let's carry on.
Thank you so much for hosting this, and thank you, Susan, for a really thoughtful presentation. My name is Scott Shang. I'm just curious what you think this means for scientists. So given the recommendations you have, does this mean that scientists should be more transparent in their own assumptions, which you suggested, but does that mean they should also not be so afraid of engaging in the policy debates themselves? There's a real reluctance, as you know, of scientists to engage and claim that they're somehow set apart from policy, but are you suggesting they should lean in and be more engaged?
Well, you know, certainly there are, and this brings up the EPA's announcement this week about EPA announced that it had several science advisory panels, and it announced that it's not automatically renewing members of their science panels, but that they welcome nominations. I think the answer to your question is two parts. First, when agencies seek information from panels like this and from scientists in a formal way, the way they do through these science advisory panels, they should be very clear in the charges they give, the questions they ask, to be asking questions that are scientific questions rather than questions about policies, which scientists don't have a comparative advantage on. They don't have an advantage over others. And I would say that might be something that scientists should try to do, to be very explicit. This is my science. This is what I understand from the science, but if they're going to talk about what policy decisions, they should take off their hat, take off their lab coat, and say, now I'm speaking in my personal policy preference. It's hard to do. None of us can do that, really, but if they're going to lean in and be effective and not tarnish the name of science, I think they should try very hard to take off their lab coat when they're going to talk about policy.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We still have two questions pending.
Professor,
go ahead,
my question relates Right. Professor, my question relates to an article written by Kimberly Strass in the Wall Street Journal last month about science integrity officials at the EPA. Is it your view that these folks are not in any way useful in their role?
I missed part of what you said. Is it the science staff at EPA or the advisory committees or what?
It is a person with the title Science Integrity Official.
I don't know what I think about that. I actually know that individual, and I think she has a lot of integrity, the person who has that position. I think people will often think that people who agree with me have integrity and people who disagree with me on policy don't have integrity. And so I think it's hard to try to parse out what's integrity, you know, where the science ends and the policy just begins. And I think that's the best, that would be my strongest advice for a science integrity official, would be to try to make clearer where the science ends and say we're not going to go past that point, but even in that realm where we're trying to make prediction based on science, be much more explicit and transparent about what assumptions and judgments went into that decision. I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you, Professor.
All right. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Just one question pending at this point, then our lines are wide open. Let's move on to our next caller.
Hi, Susan. Julie Smith here. Again, thanks for a very interesting presentation, and I look forward to reading the paper as well. I wonder if what we're facing here isn't almost a perfectly closed Rubik's Cube of self-interest on the part of regulators who would prefer to hand it off to the people in the lab coats, much like a lot of us who you know worry about excessive delegation of authority from the Congress to the agencies. Likewise, I think the people in the agencies would love to have the responsibility for difficult policy choices removed from their shoulders and hand it off to scientists. And scientists, like the rest of us, kind of like power. So they're willing to take it. How do we start to get in between those interlocking self-interests?
Yeah, I think the incentives and the current process, especially the one that I describe in more detail in the paper, are exactly as you described. So Congress can pass a law that says we're going to mandate clean air based on science. So that sounds wonderful to their constituents. Then it gets passed to the agencies, and there are people in the agencies who may have very strong policy views about what that means and how the standards should be set. So their motivations are to, I don't want to use a word that's too strong, but in all those, there are multiple assumptions and decisions that have to be made in making a prediction about health effects from exposure to a pollutant. And in every step of the way, if you make a decision that overstates the harm, by the end of that, you have a policy recommendation that is much different than if you had perhaps used more balanced judgments along the way. Then is your point that then the policy officials, there's nothing in it for them if they go against their scientists. If you look at EPA's history, whenever the administrator goes against the scientists' recommendations, they're pilloried in the press and criticized as being anti-science. And so all the incentives are there for exactly as you described, for the decisions to be made by technical staff without any of us knowing what really went into them. So our paper has a lot of different recommendations, and the few that I summarized, I think, could go part way towards that. And I guess I won't reiterate them again, but I'd love to talk to you more about that offline.
Right. Well, I appreciate it, because trying to pry all of that open is very, very difficult, as you obviously understand.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
What this is Dean Reuter, Susan. What are how is it that some of these methodologies are not disclosed? You know, with all the calls for government transparency and with Freedom of Information Act. You know, I'm very pleased with our Teleforum conference calls here, and one aspect of them is that they're recorded, posted online as podcasts, and downloaded. And I can come up with a formula for the downloads, which have been increasing, and show that, you know, given the trend line, that within my lifetime, every man, woman, and child in the entire world will be listening to Teleforum podcasts. Now, if somebody looks at my methodology behind that, which is legitimate, but it's just not correct, how is it that the public is not able to get behind the methodology that the scientists are using sometimes?
First of all, it can be very complex. And so when there are a lot of different data sets, and there's so much uncertainty in these decisions, or in the predictions that are made, and it's very difficult to look back after the fact and determine and evaluate whether the predictions were right, because that's the key part of the scientific method is you make your hypothesis, then you gather the data to see if you were right, or you have a theory of what will happen, you hypothesize, you gather your data. We never gather the data and look back. It's very hard to do that because so many of the predictions you know, EPA is often predicting respiratory impacts from different chemicals or different exposure to different things or premature death. Looking at those things, it's very hard. We all die eventually, so it's hard to go back and say these were caused by different this pollutant or this change in policy led to this reduction in deaths or coughs. And the fact that there's so many things that go into it, choosing which shape of the model to use. I mean, you could use one like yours that would be obviously wrong, but there's nothing obviously wrong with any of the things that agencies are using. It's just if at each step along the way, we're relying on an assumption that just slightly overstates risks, we may end up with a number that at the end is very very different from what the actual outcome would be. And this fact that it's difficult to measure after the fact makes it almost impossible to catch those kinds of little biases along the way.
We do have a couple more questions now pending from our audience members, so let's turn it back over to the audience.
Hi, this is Scott Shang again. I was just curious whether your paper deals at all with the Chevron doctrine, given that it's going to be published in a Supreme Court publication, and whether this understanding of science and policy and how they interrelate suggests that the doctrine should be strengthened or weakened. Should the court give more deference because it's all just policy in the end in some ways, or less deference because it needs to guard against policy-based decisions that aren't sound?
Well, I'll caveat first by saying I'm not a lawyer. So you can ignore everything that I'm about to say. But I think the Chevron the deference to agencies reinforces the science charade because it makes it all the more important. If EPA were to lay its cards on the table and say, we really do not know what is protective of public health with an adequate margin of safety. We don't even know what that statutory standard means, and we certainly couldn't give you analysis that is clear that we are protecting public health with a standard set at this level, but we're not protective above that, and we are protective below it. If they were to say that and say, you know, we just have no idea, they would be trounced in the court. So in order to succeed in subsequent litigation, which there usually is on these standards, EPA must present its information as if it is very certain. It has to hide all the uncertainties and bury them in that science judgment that they make. So I think deference to the agencies when they are, you know, in that case makes that, I think it makes it worse. Whereas if there were less deference and if agencies had to show beyond a preponderance of a doubt or, you know, stronger evidence test rather than not being arbitrary and capricious, I think perhaps they would be more open to laying out all the assumptions that were involved and being more open to different levels of the standard as a result. So all you lawyers, does that make sense?
I think you get 15 different answers.
Did you have a follow-up caller?
I did, just in the sense that maybe then the, what you should really focus on is making sure for court review that the agency has revealed the uncertainties, that if you really can show, I think making the standard so high that there's no doubt, then nothing would ever happen, because apparently mm-hmm. climate change is in doubt. But if you made it, you have to really show your work, and that if the person opposing the rulemaking or challenging it can show that there were hidden assumptions that weren't brought to the surface, that should be a basis for overruling.
Yeah,
sure.
I think that makes sense. I mean, one of the recommendations that we have is that actually present assessments of risk using different, you know, look at what are the key, you know, feasible assumptions, and lay out explicitly, if we use these assumptions and this model and this set of data, we get this answer. If we follow a different path using different assumptions, which are equally plausible, we get a different answer. That would be very valuable for policy. I don't know what courts would do with it, but I think it would help. It would make policymakers, and this gets back to last caller Julie, who said policymakers themselves love to be able to hide behind the science. Policymakers would have to make the tough decisions, because they would be presented with, okay, here are different possible scenarios. We don't know which one is right, but you have to make your policy based on that.
Does that ever happen in today's world that you're aware of, that an agency will produce different results on one question using different methodologies and then present the different findings?
Not that I'm aware of. It's a recommendation that a former head of EPA's Office of Research and Development has made, and I find it a very compelling one, George Gray. But as far as I know, I have not seen it, no. And maybe there are callers who know in different situations.
What about, and forgive me if you've addressed this, the idea of sort of a third-party look back, that is that, you know, 10 years down the road after the predictions were made, a third independent party checks to see if, you know, whether we were right or wrong. Is that being addressed anywhere? Is that a good thing? Good idea?
I think it is, and I think there's nothing preventing that now, other than the data on which agencies rely to make their decision in the first place often are not made public. There are statistical tools that can kind of rule out when we you know, you can always look at things and see correlations, but correlation does not necessarily mean causation. And there are statistical tools that could be applied to see, did this action caused this result? As I say, though, so often the things that we're predicting in the environmental health area are things that the predictions, even though they seem large in the context of a particular regulation, when you look at it in the context of the whole human population, it's very hard to tease out which of these health effects, whether there was any reduction at all.
Yeah, does that then become an argument for not regulating in the first place? If you can't nail this down, then sort of let the market control it?
I certainly haven't. I mean, I think that some people might make that case, and the case that is made in the ambient air quality standards is sometimes, well, the science is too uncertain, so we can't act, or the science is so uncertain, therefore we must act. So that uncertainty, I think, has been used both ways, Dean.
Right. Interesting. Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending.
Thanks again for this call. Gary Wheaton up here in New Hampshire again. I don't practice in this area, but you sounded like you made a pretty good legal argument, so I'll give you that. my question is, in addition to the work that you're doing and the website that you gave us earlier, can you give us listeners any other sources of, or should I say reliable sources, credible sources of people, that are, or in particular scientists, that have done some work in particularly in the area of global warming, for example, and air quality, that you can you could point out that, that have done good counter work in this area? Is there any names or studies that you can point to in that area?
You know, my our paper focuses on the air quality, the criteria pollutants in Clean Air Act lingo, and in the paper there are citations to what I think are some very interesting analyses and research, and I think there will be other things as part of this Supreme Court economic review, especially things that I think are more related to the legal aspects. I probably should have said this in response to Scott's question a couple minutes ago. So maybe the editor of that symposium issue will take note and get back to you all on that. And the climate change, I just have not been as involved in that, so I couldn't comment on that. There was one, and I'm going to forget his name, but one former EPA scientist, Robert Lackey, who's in Oregon. He's someone that I cited in the paper, and I think he has some very interesting insights on this issue.
Thanks.
Let me make a call for a final question. If you have a question, now's the time. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. We do have one more question, so see if we can... We have now two questions, but go right ahead, caller.
Fred Young, a political question. Your presentation is very interesting, but I am pessimistic. The personnel who are working in the EPA are, shall we say, biased in one direction, and I can't imagine that in the next couple of years that is going to change their policy perspective, so on and so forth. Would you comment on a political question?
Yeah, I think it's... I'm not very politically astute, so it may not be a satisfying comment, Fred. I think it is fair to say that every one of us has biases and priors, and we review things through those lenses. And to the extent that staff at the agencies do have a set of priors that may differ from their political appointees, it certainly does make it. Yes, I think that would be challenging to the appointees. I think some of these simpler things that if we could change the incentives just a little bit, and I think laying out the assumptions and models would be one way to do that, that would engage more than just a small group of people in the decision. So engaging a broader public debate over what really are this. You know, separates that what are the right assumptions and scientific choices to be made, and also what are the right policy choices to be made. If a larger group of individuals could be engaged in that through earlier notices where more of this information is laid out so that people can comment not after the agency has decided on what the right number is, so that they're kind of it's carved in stone. I agree with you. It's not going to be easy because institutions don't change easily, but if we could change some of the incentives, I think it could be improved.
Thank you.
We do have one more question. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
There's an awful lot of regulation going on, which has nothing to do with the good of the people. The Monsanto's close relationship with the FDA and the FDA's bias against natural remedies, these are not the products of science. These are the products of influence. And I'll just tell one horror story that an environmental lawyer told me about the enforcement, which can have huge devastating effects. A fire occurred in a small chemistry shop that had a chemistry set, and when the fire inspector came in and saw the chemicals he had on his shelf, he called in the EPA, and the EPA took these chemicals, which were harmless in their containers, and proceeded to dump them all together in 55 gallon drums to dispose of them. I'm not sure where. Pour chromium, zinc chromate down down the drain into the municipal sewer system, and do all sorts of things which anybody else would have been imprisoned for. And they said, we're the APA, we can do that. I mean, you can't object to the way we're disposing of it. They even took some toxic chemicals up to West Point and blew them up on the bomb range. So the amount of deference, it seems to me the Chevron rule and the amount of deference is a huge problem whenever you're dealing with environmental regulators. And it comes from an attitude that grew up in the FDR administration, as the court was packed with big government advocates.
Any response, Susan Dudley? Not a question, but a statement.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wasn't aware of that situation.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry, caller. Go ahead.
The enforcement situation. Or the situation with regulators falling, being captured by the people they're supposedly regulating.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with your the case that you just mentioned, that scenario that you just mentioned. Yes, I think, and this is probably separate from the science issue, but yes, I think regulatory capture is a big problem in regulation. I have other papers that go into that, so I think that is a problem.
Yeah.
I believe we've had our final question today, Susan Dudley. You want to take a minute and express a final thought or wrap up?
You know, if we will try to post this paper on the website, and if people do have suggestions, I welcome them. Somebody had asked, I think it was Gary from New Hampshire, who asked about other things to read. I do think that Bipartisan Policy Center report from 2009 was really quite interesting, and also the Keystone Center report that I mentioned. I think they have good suggestions for how we can get out of this problem that we have.
Very good. Well, my thanks to Susan Dudley on my own behalf, but also on behalf of the Federal Society. Thank you very much, Susan, for this. It's been very, very interesting. I want to thank our audience as well for dialing in, for your thoughtful questions. A reminder about our next scheduled Teleform conference call. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. at this same number. We'll be talking about Ziegler versus Abbasi. That's a Bivens case, talking about liability of government actors dating back to the initial moments of the war on terror. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.